I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, along with John, KC2WGB, Paul WS2N, and Hal K6DPZ. We run this thing called the Technical Man. As you guys know, it's a gathering of the guys who are interested in radio, wireless in particular, sometimes other subjects of interest in science, and we discuss all that with each other and teach each other. That's the general purpose. The way you sign into the Technical Man, if you do have a question or a comment, is to give that crowd, me and the others, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. Great big long list of people signing in are not required. This net has existed for 31 years, since 1982 in September. By now, we don't have to be proven to us that somebody is listening. So it'll save us some time if you're only signing in because you have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. Let me drop. WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your call letters, name, and check in right now if you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
KC2MMY, Ray, yes.
N1YDY, Hank, yes.
Okay, I got Ray and Hank. YDY, what's the prefix, Hank?
November 1, Yankee Delta Yankee.
We got you, Hank. Okay, Ray and Hank. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey in the mobile. Name here is Joe, and, call out, and if I'm back in the mobile later on tonight, I'll be back.
Very fine, Joe. Quick question, Joe. Should we take you immediately because you're within range on your mobile, or if we don't get to you for 30 minutes, will you still be within range either at mobile or home? Give us a guess on that one, Joe. KC2, QIW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Roger, thank you for asking. You could put me last on the last list. You could put me last because later on I gotta check my friend Sky Rome, you know. So I'll be up kind of late. Back to the net. Thank you.
Okay, very thoughtful. You want us to put you last, Joe. Okay. Another call? Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul. With the space report. Good evening, everybody. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Looking for that space report. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, for the time being, there may be none. Looks like we might be a little bit late tonight, Ray, so we can go nice and slow and get all the details of your question. KC2MMY, K2LIW in TechNet. You got it, Ray.
Hi, Dick, and everyone on the TechNet. Just a quick question, really, tonight. Just curious, I know you do RC stuff, and I have 3 or 4 RC radios, I think from about 15 years ago. They're 72 megahertz, I think. I wonder if I can still use them, what the law is. And if the law says, no, you can't use those anymore, what'll happen to me if I do? Anyway, because, I mean, they're good radios. They're like new, some of them, and I don't want them to go to waste. So here you do RC stuff, so I was curious if you could answer that. Thanks. KC2MMY in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was aware that you were trying to ask that question the other night, Ray, and there was a much more important subject on the floor, so to speak, and we had to stick with that particular subject because of the ongoing situation with Rich and various people who are trying to figure out what should his next move be and the next move of his attorney and so on. Alrighty, when it comes to radio control equipment of, let me pick a number, 1970, when I first, I guess it was 1976 when I got pretty serious into it. Kraft was the most popular brand name, 72 megacycles was the most popular frequency, so-called analog-like equipment on
Oh, about 6 or 8 frequencies that were available on 72 megs. And when you went to a contest, you received a clothespin for that particular frequency or color code for that particular frequency that you clipped onto the antenna. And they impounded the transmitters to make sure that nobody turned on a transmitter at the wrong time and crashed somebody's airplane. And if at that contest your number had come up and you're ready for the competition, they gave you your transmitter back with the clothespin on it, pinning down the frequency. That gives you some idea of what it was like then. Boy, have things changed. Let me drop them. I'm not sure of the exact number, but approximately 15 years ago, the original frequencies used for radio control boats, cars, and airplanes, three separate frequency regions, all changed. All those frequencies moved. The modulation method that you're allowed to use changed. If you made the mistake of flying your airplane on one of the old frequencies, where the new frequencies are such that the old ones are now being used by a commercial business, so-called, I think it was a license-free set of frequencies set aside, there was a good possibility that if you flew your airplane on the old frequencies, that somebody that's now there as a commercial legal user would be crashing your airplane. So the chances of you being able to use those old frequencies now legally, and there's ways you can check this out with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, AMA, by going to their website, FCC. There's lots of ways, even there's Google sites you can go to where you can find out what are the new legal 72 megacycle frequencies for aircraft, boats, and cars. Let me drop. And a couple of my friends who are very electronically well educated bought new crystals, moved to the new frequencies, and changed the methods of modulation so that it met the new narrowband standards. When they changed the frequencies, they also changed the bandwidth that you were allowed to use. So one particular friend went through the effort because he had quite a few transmitters. He went and modified them all. A lot of rigmarole. Not worth it, in my opinion, as I see it, Ray, for one main reason. Dollars and man hours. He put a lot of man hours into it. Nowadays, you can buy a very high quality radio control transmitter for numbers like $100 with six channels and a couple of servos and the transmitter and the receiver. The number of dollars required these days is not very large, and is another huge improvement. For those modern day dollars that you spend on a transmitter, most likely it's not going to be on 72 megs, it's going to be on 2 gigs. The advantage of 2 gigs in digital is that it is a hell of a lot less vulnerable to jamming. You go to a contest like the one I went to last September. Let me drop. I'm talking about the NEAT Fair that was held in the Catskills of New York State. That was the 11th annual NEAT Fair, NEAT, Northeast Aero Electronic. In other words, this is a purely battery-operated aircraft competition in which there were something in the vicinity of 200 pilots and something like 300 vendors selling things on that field for 3 or 4 solid days. And quite a gathering. But when you have now hundreds of pilots all on 2 gigs, you would assume they're jamming the daylights out of each other. One of the events of that contest is a kind of controlled warfare where you launch about 50 airplanes in the air simultaneously, and they're all weaving in and out through each other, and some of them have streamers, and you're allowed to go cut the other guy's streamer and so on. It's kind of a combat, and it's a mass warfare combat. The modern-day 2-gig transmitters are so unique in their individual digital codes that they no longer can jam each other. You don't bother impounding the transmitters. You don't worry about somebody turning on a transmitter and jamming your aircraft. Your particular transmitter becomes bonded, as they call it, to your particular receiver. When you first turn the system on, it scans the frequency regions, finds out if anybody is using that frequency, and if so, it goes to another frequency, communicates that information to the receiver, and the two of them go to the new frequency, the new method of modulation, and they get their own separate channel. You can operate hundreds of aircraft simultaneously on the new 2-gig channels. They're a hell of a lot less jammable. They're not very expensive, and they get all kinds of computer controls built in where you can computer control control various sequences in order to do certain maneuvers. You can couple the ailerons to the elevator if you want to, because they're cross-coupled in the real airplane.
Repeater, time out.
These modern-day transmitters have got fancy microprocessors built in, a screen that'll tell you what's going on. Quite a few of them will have telemetry feedback. In other words, the battery on board the airplane, the voltage of that battery is being fed back to you, and your transmitter in your hand has got a display telling you how much time is left on that battery that you're flying, and it's communicating in both directions. With that kind of capability, for the kind of dollars you and I can easily afford, a little bit more expensive than a handy-talky, it's not as cheap as a Baofeng or a Wuxon radio, but still you get an awful lot for your money. So should you use that 72 megs? I think the answer is no. When you check on the frequencies, I think you're going to find out it's illegal. And if you did use it for controlling an airplane, I think you're going to get jammed. And for you to have the right bandwidth of the new technique on 72 megs, let me give you one other piece of information. 72 megs by the modern-day aircraft users is almost unused. When you go to these contests, they do have a board set up with clothespins for 72 megs, and nobody is using it. There were something close to 200 or 300 pilots on that field when my son and I went there last September, and to my knowledge, not one single one of them was using 72 megs. That gives you some of what I know about that one, Ray. KC2MMY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, roger that. I guess I can, I'll use them for, you know, robotics or experimentation or something. I hate to throw them away because I think some of them were pretty expensive. And just as a last note, no big deal. Like, I like to play with stuff anyway, so I'll use them for something. But just as a last note, there was one radio card that I bought that came with the radio, and that was only like 4 years ago, and it came, and believe it or not, the frequency is 27 megahertz, and I don't know if you heard me talk to Gabe earlier, it's not a cheapy 27 megahertz, it's a good digitally proportionally controlled AM 27 megahertz, so I'm wondering just quickly if you know if there's something different with that, those are legal, because it was only purchased like 4 years ago new. So, and that would be my last statement. Thank you, KC2MMY with K2RIW in the segment.
I've been to a couple of events on Long Island. I've been to this huge event in, I can't even think of the name of the town. Schinopol, I think it's the name of the town in New York where the NEAT Fair is held every year. And if you Google the words NEAT, N-E-A-T, Fair, F-A-I-R, or if you Google the word Seafly, Silent Electric Flyers of Long Island, and you start reading what these guys are doing at their meetings when they're holding contests and whatever, you will discover that 27 megs is even less used than 72. I don't think anybody's using 72 anymore. So those transmitters and receivers on those frequencies, for aircraft, I would never use it. In the case of a car or a boat, I guess the chances of somebody jamming your low-altitude object like that are fairly slim, and even if a car or a boat got jammed, it's nowhere near as destructive as when an airplane gets jammed. There's something else you'd like to know, and that is the actual little motors that move the control surfaces on the aircraft, the so-called servo motors, those are usable. In other words, the actual information that's sent to the servo motor itself, way back in 1970 versus 2013, the signal going to the actual servo motor is the same. So therefore, you can reuse those servo motors if you want to. You may have to remount a new connector on the end because the modern-day receiver has rather small connectors that you can put six or eight of them plugged into the same receiver and move the wheels, the motor, the ailerons, the flaps, the air brakes, the elevator, the rudder, and all kinds of things like that, and make the pilot's head swish back and forth. You can do all kinds of things simultaneously with a modern-day 6-channel, 8-channel, 12-channel receivers. So they got a smaller connector. And you might have to remount connectors. You can use those certain...
Repeater, timeout.
You'll be able to reuse those servos, but the electronics itself, I wouldn't trust it on an aircraft for a boat or a car, I would consider it, but then you even got to be careful what kind of a car. An electric-powered car, I would go for that. Some of these gasoline-powered radio-controlled cars that are capable of moving 60 and 70 miles an hour, I wouldn't want to use a radio that I wouldn't highly trust in a thing like that, because if it goes in the wrong direction at the wrong speed at the wrong time, it can do an awful lot of damage. As you look further into this raid, please come back and tell us what you find. But I've given you a scratch the surface, so to speak, of what I know, what I have seen recently, and my opinions on the subject. It's not the last word on this subject, but still, at 72 megs, be careful. And with the inexpensive, high-technology, 2-gig stuff that's digitally operated these days, boy, you get a lot for your money. And therefore, you got to consider it. Back to you, Ray, for any final KC2MMY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you for the info. Yeah, I do have quite a few servos then with the standard Futaba connectors on them. I'll just get... I'll just have to get a modern-day radio, that's all. But no, thank you for the info. That's basically what I wanted to know, so thank you very much.
A comment will pick you up in a second. I'm rather forgetful on brand names. My son, Christopher, KC2, boy, am I great on remembering call letters, IQN, KC2IQN. He did a significant amount of research on this exact subject a couple of months ago. He selected a particular brand name. We weren't trying to buy the cheapest. We were trying to buy something of moderate price that had a lot of capability with servo capability, telemetry capability. They come built in telling you the battery voltage, and by adding a couple of extra circuits, you can then pipe back down to the ground what is the speed and altitude and battery voltage and G's of turn. All kinds of information can be fed back from the airplane. And that can be really a lot of fun if you're flying one of these quadcopter type things. There's also something these days that's becoming popular that's called first person piloting. You literally have a camera on board the airplane. You wear a headset that shows you the screen of what the camera sees on the airplane. And you fly it like the real pilot from the ground, if you know what I mean. And imagine how exciting it is. Let me drop this. Imagine how exciting it is when you're flying the airplane up nice and high and you aim the airplane toward the pilot on the ground, meaning you. You're seeing yourself from space while you're controlling that airplane, while the thing's approaching you. I've seen people do that. Pretty exciting stuff. Person with a comment. Who was that? Give us your call letters and name. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Hi there, Dick. It's Victor Echo 3 X-Ray Sierra Hotel, Christian in Toronto, with a comment.
V3 X-Ray Sierra Hotel. Go right ahead, Christian.
A few years ago, I was still messing around with the analog radios and was very frustrated with all the jitter. And, I found that if a radio was even just a few years old, that some part of you, the transmitter or receiver, was going out, and you just get a lot of jitter and interference. And as soon as I tried using the Spectrum systems, and that's the systems that I like to use, Spectrum radio, they're just phenomenal. The way that you can program so many curves to control different sort of types of aircraft, the way you can do V-tail mixing or you can do elevon mixing, so that if you've got a delta wing aircraft that's got no ailerons or elevators, but just has the two, ailerons working as elevators or ailerons, you can program that stuff in the transmitter. And also, you can buy one transmitter and you can use it for a helicopter or an airplane or a glider or what have you, and after a while you realize you've got about four different aircraft and about five different receivers, and it's all being driven off of the same radio. So if people haven't yet really looked into that technology yet, I think that they're going to have their minds blown by how amazing it is. And I know a lot of people using the Futaba, and some people using Spectrum. I really enjoy the Spectrum. And also the idea of being able to put four AA's into a transmitter and have that work for days on end. without changing them. I mean, literally getting hours of flight time out of just a set of batteries, you know, it's unbelievable. So for me personally, I would never go back to analog. Thanks.
Very well done, Christian. Yeah, I was getting back into radio control, you know, 6 months or so ago, my son and I, having been into it in the late 70s, and my goodness, has the technology moved since then. And Christian was indicating some of that. Spectrum is one of the very good brand names, and I can't remember the other one. It'll come to me in a minute. The one that we buy Spectrum or we buy the other one. I know there was a close race between the two. But the radio in your hand, not only can you use that radio to control a car, a boat, three aeroplanes, and two helicopters, so to speak, and you have different programming for each one of those craft. In other words, servo number three might be an elevator on one, it might be the rudder on the other, it might require reversing. In the old days, if you hooked up the rudder to the servo mechanism and it moved in the wrong direction, you'd have to mechanically rewire things. Nowadays, you just tell the electronics, hey, do the opposite, and do it with an exponential curve, or a linear curve, or a logarithmic curve, as far as the sensitivity. In other words, high sensitivity when you push the control stick a large distance, but when you push the control stick a small distance, it has low sensitivity, and it can slowly proportion between the two. Let me drop. So, you turn on the transmitter, and it literally asks you, which one of the craft are we controlling? Is it helicopter number two, or is it fixed-wing aircraft number three? And are you pilot number one or pilot number two? In other words, you could have different rate controls for those exact same aircraft, depending on whether you're the father or the son that's acting as the pilot. So you can program the transmitter to take all of that data and to properly use it at the right time with that particular aircraft, with that particular pilot. They've come a long way. The microprocessor in there is doing fantastic things. And like Christian said, very low in battery drain on the transmitter. Very little power is required these days because the receiver is so sensitive, because it's using spread spectrum techniques. And those spread spectrum techniques is part of the reason why you could have hundreds of aircraft flying simultaneously, all on 2 gigahertz, all on the same field, and each transmitter talks to that particular receiver only. And all the other receivers will ignore the signal from your particular transmitter. And so, as you can tell, they've come a long way. With a little bit of your problem is going to be, Ray, when it comes to buying a new one, you've got a large number of choices. It's a little bit like, let me drop it. A guy who just got his ham license and is getting into ham radio for the first time, he's going to talk to his friends and say, boy, when I look at the advertisements in the back of QST magazine, wow. There's a darn many transmitters and receivers and some darn many frequencies and modes of operation, AM and FM and sideband and CW and HF and VHF and UHF and microwave. How do I know which one to buy? And there's no easy answer to that. You have to decide what you think is going to give you the most amount of fun. Is there a particular group of guys you'd like to be associated with? Are they part of a 450 megacycle repeater group? Therefore, you're going to want to buy 450 megacycle equipment. You don't have to worry about that anymore. You buy the right radio these days, it's got 2 meters and 450 in the same radio simultaneously, and it'll switch between the two, and so on. So modern-day electronics has come a long way. And 15-year-ago electronics is, by modern standards, pretty ancient. It's almost an antique, Ray. I know that's going to hurt because you've got something that you believe was quite valuable in its day. But by modern-day standards, unfortunately, it's almost a museum piece. Any further fills you might need on what Christian or I just said, Ray, I'll turn it back to you one more time. KC2MMY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, that's pretty good, Dick. I mean, you covered most of it. Like I said, a couple of the radios were a few $100 each, but they are what they are. My own fault for not getting into the hobby. You know, more completely at an earlier time, but that's the way it goes. So, thank you very much for the info, and we'll let you go on to the next person.
Ray, even if you had gotten into the hobby at a much earlier time, as I did, even so, with all that capability of modern day equipment, you would be rebuying new equipment anyhow, in my opinion. And there's a limited length of time in which that 72 megs was appropriate. In its day, Kraft was a Cadillac brand name, 72 megs was the main frequency, and that's what everybody was using in, let's say, 1973 or so. But, boy, it's a lot of water under the bridge since then, and my goodness, you go to a modern-day contest, and you see what these battery-powered airplanes can do. They literally have more speed, more power, more duration than gasoline-powered. And you no longer have the problem of all the castor oil coming out of the engine, smeared all over the airplane, and you got to wash it down afterwards, and you put up with the smell and the noise. These electric-powered things, in the beginning, electric-powered aircraft were fleet-powered airplanes. Oh, boy, they've come a long way. Let me drop. With the modern-day lithium polymer batteries, real compact, light things with high energy density, and with these brushless DC motors that have got ridiculous number of horsepower. I mean, the little bitty motor that my son is using on his airplane, I think the motor is in the vicinity of 1 inch in diameter and 1.25 inches long. That little electric motor, which only weighs a couple of ounces, as a brushless DC motor, properly fed from it's being fed with about 12 volts, creates 3/4 of a horsepower. That airplane, that simple little light little airplane, will go straight up in the air and go out of sight in about 10 seconds if you command it to do that. You can't get anywhere near that energy density, power density, and a gasoline motor anymore. These electric things have come a long way, and they come in a zillion different sizes and a zillion different torques. You can buy a motor that'll swing a real big propeller real slow, or a tiny little propeller inside of a turbine. Let me drop. Some of these aircraft are jet engine simulators. In other words, everything from the outside of the airplane looks like a jet engine. You look down the tube where the air goes in, you'll see a tiny little propeller running at something like 30,000 RPM with a brushless DC motor. So, boy, these things have capability. Okay, Hank was the next guy on our list. November 1, Yankee Delta Yankee, if I wrote it down correctly, Hank, K2RAW, go right ahead.
Hey, Dick, and everybody else in that. I have three questions, and I'll throw the first two out, and if we have time, I'll throw that out later. The first question is, I have an amplified speaker, actually a computer speaker. It's stereo, and it has an adapter that allows it to get driven by my mono output on my ST530HT. And no matter what I do, I get RF into it. If I have it hooked up to the HT and I transmit, I get RF. If I swap the HT for another and transmit, I don't get RF into it. And I'm trying to figure out where the RF is getting into it. I think I just misspoke when I said if I could swap it out. I wanted to say if I took another ST530 and put it in place, because I have two of them on the first, I still get the RF if I've got the speaker hooked up to the radio that's transmitting. But if I transmit on a different radio next to the one that's there, I don't get it into it.
Yeah, when I passed it over to you, you're lucky you didn't time it out. You didn't wait for the three beeps, Hank. Turns out that, if I understand you correctly, you're taking the audio output from your handy talkie and plugging it into a hi-fi speaker system, and the RF is giving you a lot of grief. I presume by that you mean that when you're receiving, no problem, you didn't say, but I'm guessing now, that when you transmit, you'd like the speaker to be quiet, and the speaker is making some kind of noise, and maybe your audio is coming through when you transmit. Maybe that's the RF coupling. And let me show you what I think is going on here. Under normal circumstances, that audio output from your handy talkie is intended to go to a speaker mic. A speaker mic is a kind of a small loudspeaker with no additional amplification in most cases. The speaker mic itself is usually pretty passive, particularly when it comes to the audio output. As such, if any leaky RF comes out of that audio system and hits that speaker that might be in your ear, because it's totally passive, the speaker is not going to respond. Therefore, they didn't have to try real hard to make sure that the audio output was not well shielded. The mic input, they've got to make sure that that's well shielded, because if any RF picked up from the rubber duck gets fed back to the mic circuit, you can create a feedback and you can end up doing some howling. Let me drop. So that mic circuit is probably very well RF shielded, but the audio output does not have to be. And even though you can have two identical rigs with just a different serial number, the amount of audio output on that, the amount of RF output on that audio line could be very different, because in some cases, that audio output is a piece of shielded cable inside, and depending the way they dressed that shielded cable, the two consecutive serial numbers can have that shielded cable going inside. It traverses alongside of a RF printed circuit board. In one case, it's a little bit closer to the board, maybe only a 32nd of an inch of difference, but that can drastically make the difference in the amount of RF it picks up. And therefore, that cable coming out, the audio output cable, is a kind of internal antenna picking up RF energy and coupling it to the outside world. Ordinarily, when you're running that to a speaker mic, the fact that the 3 watts is coming out of the rubber duck and a couple of milliwatts of RF is coming out of the audio output cable, that wouldn't really make any difference under normal operation. Not many guys hook up a hi-fi the way you did and have seen this RF sensitivity. So that's my best guess as to what's going on. There are some relatively simple solutions. By various means you could use, if you were very well equipped, you'd use a spectrum analyzer and you'd look at the magnitude of the RF output on the audio line. Let me drop. And if you've got a real good RFI, EYE, if you've got some experience with electromagnetic compatibility, electromagnetic interference measurements, you would take a good physical look inside and say, gee, I don't like the way that particular cable is dressed, and if I put a 1,000 picofarad disc ceramic capacitor right here as an RF bypass to make sure that no RF energy is leaving on that line coming out of the handy-talkie, and a 1,000 picofarad ceramic capacitor will have no effect on the audio, but it might attenuate the RF by 20 dB, and it's a 10-cent part. Adding that part inside the radio could very easily fix it. So it is a fixable problem, but you have to first find out where it's coming from, and doing some RF sniffing is one way to do it, although it's not easy. By using the RF output from the handy-talkie, let me drop it. If the RF output from the handy-talkie, you unplug the rubber duck and you plug in a real adapter that can now take a well-shielded cable into a dummy load or to an antenna that's very far away, but the dummy load would be the best. If the RF output, main RF output of the handy-talkie, was going into a dummy load that is itself well-shielded, and now you have a second handy-talkie with a small piece of cable going into it. It's being used in the receive mode. You have a small sniffer loop at the end of its piece of cable. In other words, the semiconductor comes out for half an inch, loops back into and is soldered to the shield, and now you have the small sniffing loop, and you hold it near various things on the suspect handy-talkie while it's transmitting. You'll be able to find out how much RF energy is where by finding out what you listen to, if you know what I mean. If it has a signal strength meter, you'll even get quantitative data out of it. So there's various techniques by which you can quantify the amount of RF, and or maybe that's an academic experiment, maybe you don't want to do it, you just throw in the ceramic bypass capacitor and the problem goes away. But that circuit was never guaranteed by the manufacturer to have low RF output on its audio output, because under normal circumstance, that's not a problem. N1YDY, K2RIW, wait for the four beeps, Hank.
Hey, I understood most of what you said. I have one piece of additional information I should have given you before we started, and that is when I used a 12-volt amplified speaker, I did not notice the RF getting into it. So I'm wondering if there is a component of the RF that's finding its way into the power line. Because it does sound when the speaker makes noise as if there is an AC hum that is accompanying the voice that is resonating out of the amplified stereo.
Okay, if you change the brand name, model number, whatever, of the audio amplification system, you're going to get a difference in response. Guaranteed. Along these lines. Because if my audio amplifier was using transistors, where the particular transistors only worked up to, let me pick a number, 1 megahertz, and they fall off in response real fast, the presence of a 144 megacycle signal there would do nothing, and the audio amplifier would ignore it. Go to the next audio amplifier where the guy inadvertently used real high-quality transistors that are good to 200 megacycles, and so the 144 megacycle signal is going into the emitter base junction of that second audio system. It's being rectified. It's creating a DC voltage that's changing the bias on that transistor. So, believe it or not, this is one of those situations where if they used higher quality transistors in your audio amplifier, you could get into a lot more trouble. Now, you could either stop the problem at the source, in other words, enough bypassing of the audio circuitry of the handy talkie so that you knock down the amount of RF that comes out of that audio line. That's one approach. The other approach is to take your audio amplifier system and put dis-ceramic bypass capacitors in it so that the RF energy can't get into it, so that it gets bypassed even before it gets into that circuit. The guy who built your audio amplifier never intended it to operate alongside of a multi-watt handy talkie at 144 megacycles. Therefore, he didn't worry about RF bypassing and careful shielding and whatever of the wiring and the quality of the transistors he used. And so with a dollar's worth of parts, you can fix it on either end once you identify who is the source and who is the vulnerable circuit.
Repeater, timeout.
And I've just given you some guesses as to where I think the source and the vulnerability is, the susceptibility. N1YDY, K2RIW, wait for the beeps, and you got it, Hank.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the discussion of transistor operating frequency, because it is a high-quality set of amplified speakers, and of course, that was not ever intended for you next to, as you say, the multi-watt HD radiator. And that certainly explains the difference between that and the amplified speaker that I use, which was designed for radio communication gear, even though it is a radio show product. And I think that you hit the nail on the head. I can really as easily envision that that's the issue. So if I can stop with that and go to question number two, and let me drop and pick it up.
Stand by a second, Hank. Hank, either somebody is sleeping in your house and you're speaking very softly, or you're talking under the back of the mic instead of the front of the mic. Your audio is a full 10 dB lower than you wish it was. N1YDY, K2RIW.
I'll talk a little louder. I am actually screaming a little bit. Is this any better? N1YDY.
You just came up 8 dB and you sound beautiful. Please keep doing it. Go ahead.
Right. One of the problems I have as an HT operator, I'm using the speaker mic, is that I'm used to different forms of communication when I used to use them at work, and I forget that I have to basically shout into this one. I'm used to much more sensitive mics at work. Anyway, the other question I have relates to using auto-tuners in mobile applications with helical coil wound whips. I am in possession of both an SGC-230 and a Veruno Marine antenna tuner. I know how to operate either one with my with an ICOM that I will put into the mobile, a 706, but that's irrelevant. And the question, though, that is what I want to know is about the antenna itself and the length of an antenna that I would have to use in order to resonate the entire ham band down 160 in the mobile. Let me drop. Actually, I just misspoke. I wanted to say down into the 80 meter band, not into the lower one, but the higher one. But not into 160. There we go. But the question is, SGC made a product that was called the STC-303, and it was a mobile antenna that had a radiator that was the length of antenna, approximately a little less than 9 feet, so it supposedly radiated at 22 megahertz, and the it had a helical coil wound around the fiberglass core, and that was supposed to radiate at 13 megahertz, and they claim that with those two combinations, their tuners would operate across the ham band. So I was wondering if I've read a number of things that the helical coil radiators are inefficient and not really the right way to use an end-fed antenna in a mobile. So I'm a little confused whether I should aim for something that is like the STC-230 or whether I should use something that is essentially a coil mounted at the base of a 102-inch stainless steel whip. N1YDY.
Yeah, when a person says that X technique of antenna tuner, transmitter, transmission line, whatever, is inefficient, to me, as a person who has a lot of respect for the law of conservation of energy, the first question that occurs in my head is, where is the inefficiency? If it's a 100-watt transmitter, and you're running key down 100 watts, and if it's running 50% inefficient, that means 50 watts is being dissipated somewhere. Tell me where the 50 watts is being dissipated. If I put more than about 3 watts into that helical coil for more than about 3 minutes, it's going to melt down. If I put, if I was dissipating more than 10 watts in the whip, the stainless steel whip itself, it would get hot to the touch, and it might even glow in the dark. About the only real inefficiency I can think of is that if the automobile itself, acting as a ground plane for 80 meters, the counterpoise, happens to have a higher than normal amount of RF on it, and you're driving over a dry soil where the soil is very absorptive, yes, you can get some inefficiency because of soil absorption. But let me backtrack here. As many of you guys have heard me say so often, every antenna you are ever going to use for the rest of your life, with a couple of rare exceptions, Rhombic and beverage antenna are the only exceptions I know of. When it comes to reasonable so-called standing wave structures, ordinary antennas, monopoles, dipoles, inverted F, log periodic, Yagi, things like that, any of the conventional antennas, rule number one, you resonate first, then you can radiate. And if it doesn't resonate, with rare exception, it will not radiate. So your whip antenna, the longer the whip, the more easy it is to impedance match, the less the current that flows into the automobile as a ground plane, therefore the less the possibility of the one inefficiency that I'll accept, and that is some of the RF energy gets coupled directly into the ground. So if you want the highest possible efficiency, let me drop. You want the highest possible efficiency on 80 meters. You make the radiator, the whip, as tall as you can tolerate. You make that whip 3 feet tall. And with the right kind of a loading coil and the right kind of antenna tuner, you will force it into resonance. But you're going to get a huge voltage out of the tip of that small whip. I've seen situations where a guy had a sharp point intentionally at the tip because he enjoyed seeing the arcing when he spoke into the microphone. The audio output, the RF output during the peaks of the sideband would create arcing, and he could hear his voice as a alternate arcing sound coming off the tip of the transmitting whip antenna. You don't want to go there, but it's kind of fun. All right, so you make the whip as long as you're willing to tolerate, and that's a function of, is it going to be so tall that it tips over the automobile? Is it going to be hitting all the trees in the neighborhood? Is it going to be running into the garage door when you try to park the car in the garage? Are you willing to bend it over and clip it down before parking your garage? You know, all of these little bitty problems. So make the whip as long as you can tolerate. Beyond that, whether you make the coil the top, the middle, the bottom, whether or not you choose a low-loss transmission line and you get a very large range antenna tuner, and now the coil electronically is in the tuner, those are your choices. So make it as long as you can, then make it resonate on each one of the frequencies you care about, and you're on the air. You're radiating, The signal is going into the sky, and it's going to do the best you can from an automobile. The only way you're going to do better than that, let me drop. The only way you're going to do better than that is if you put the automobile on a very strong crane and elevate it high in the air, or you start putting a very elaborate antennas on the automobile, like a three-element Yagi. You're not likely to do this. On an apartment building, you could do that if you own the apartment building. And there's a guy in Japan who's got this five-element, 80-meter, fully rotatable beam on top of this huge apartment building, a multi-floor apartment building. And boy, does he open up the 80-meter band. He owns the band. You and I borrowed it from him, if you know what I mean. So, as you can see, rip as long as you can get it, electronically resonate it, you're home free after that. And so, whether or not you worry about is the coil brand A or brand B, is it running inefficient? If it's inefficient, you can find out real fast. Key down for a couple of minutes, 100 watts of power, turn it off, go over there and touch everything. If it's ice cold, there is no inefficiency. The only inefficiency you can have is heat. If all the stuff you're using ain't getting hot, it is efficient. Over to you, Hank. N1YDY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Right. So I understand what you said, but the only question I still have is, should I aim for trying to make a homemade helical whipped antenna? I mean, you can buy fiberglass parts for next to nothing. I think you'd get $4 $8 for 4 feet, so you could make 3 4-feet sections, and you say clip it down, and then wind your own coil more at the top than at the bottom, or should I simply go with something like a stainless steel whip, not quite a CB knot, but something basically like that?
It is my belief it almost doesn't matter. I will worry a little bit about stainless steel. It does have higher resistivity than copper. If this is the best of all possible worlds, it would be nice to have copper-clad stainless steel for the whip. I don't think you can buy that. So when you measure the resistance of the stainless steel whip, it's a little bit of a lossy item. But once again, run a key down, go over there and touch it after you turn off the transmitter, and if it's running ice cold, you're home free. Whether you wind your own, buy it, buy the parts and build it, or go out and buy a screwdriver antenna and buy something that's a so-called turnkey operation, those are your choices. All of them will work correctly if you dot the I's and cross the T's, if you know what I mean. If you worry about the details of proper grounding and proper shielding and low-loss cables and so on, large enough range tuning network, and whether or not the coil, to really cover all of 80 meters well, it'd be nice to have a tunable coil, like a screwdriver network, because when you do the tuning in the antenna versus the antenna tuner, it's a little bit better, but that problem becomes a wash if the transmission line between the antenna tuner and the antenna is low enough in loss, and if the antenna tuner has a high enough range. Let me drop. When the antenna itself is not resonant, and you force it into resonance by way of using the antenna tuner, the non-resonant antenna means it's going to have a high standing wave ratio. Therefore, the energy is bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times in the transmission line. So if the antenna tuner is in the front of the car, and this is a station wagon, and the whip is out the back, and you've got a significant length of transmission line in there, and a small diameter transmission line, so you can easily dress it inside the car and under the rug and whatever and hide it, well, now you're starting to build up some loss, if you know what I mean. So in that case, the closer you get the antenna to resonating, the lower the insertion loss of the transmission line will be. There's lots of choices on this one, as I see it, Hank. There's no ideal solution. They will all work. And should I do A or B? It's not quite the same, but almost as crazy as saying, will I be happier if I married a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? And in all cases, there's more going on than first meets the eye in making the choice. Are you willing to address the time? Are you willing to spend the time making sure it's weatherproofed and mechanically strong enough, as opposed to taking your professional salary and writing a check and making the problem go away? There's lots of solutions. I don't know the ideal one, but there's various ways. Let me drop. There's various ways you can research this. When it comes to 80-meter mobile operation, you properly Google the right words, I guarantee there's a lot of internet articles on the subject. Guarantee that you go to the archives of QST Magazine, they've written lots of articles on the subject. And so when you look at the way various people have done it, you'll say, gee, that car looks like mine. It's got the right kind of a bumper mount. That's kind of similar. I like his bumper mount, but this other guy over here has a nicer way of building the coil. I'm going to choose that one. So by looking at the past successful attempts, if you know what I mean, you can mix and match and choose your particular way of doing it. Or you can say, hey, this is a research project. I don't want to spend the time. I'm going to choose the right brand name of a respected mobile 80-meter tunable antenna, like a screwdriver-like structure. I write a check and the problem goes away. You have all of those choices. And by the way, as you research this and you come back with an answer that works for you, Hank, please come back and tell us about it, because I guarantee there are other people listening to you right now who would like to solve this problem. There are various guys who thought putting 80-meter mobile on their car is too complicated, but if you can solve it for them, they will be very happy with you. N1YDY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, very good. And I do understand everything you've said on this one at this point. So since I already own a number of tuners, two, I think I'm going to attempt to do it that way, whether I marry a blonde or a brunette, but I'm going down the road that I already have some equipment for. And we'll give it a shot, and see which way it works. And I think I'll try the helical coil, homemade helical coil instrument first. I do like to try the same things if they are a challenge and they take more time than my professional money or my professional time is worth. I enjoy doing those installations or something from them. And finally, I have one last question. I'm looking for an HF rig that has character. It's time for a new HF rig. And new is probably the wrong word. I'm going to look and talk about some older ones. John earlier, this isn't a network. Should I marry a blonde or brunette? But I was wondering what guys thought of things like the old Kenwood TS-80 or maybe the Drake equipment, actually specifically. I'm thinking of the R7, TR-7 series of radios and their equipment.
Hank, you've slid back into talking very low, but I'm wearing earphones and I could hear everything you said, but there was a good tending to be lower than you would like it to be. TS-80, Drake, TR-7, R-7, all very nice pieces of equipment. And I guess you're talking about, you're talking about base station. Kenwood 850, 920, 970, these are popular brands. I, for one, can't answer that one for you. The best I can think of is that you'll have to check with your friends as to what are their favorite rigs. In some cases, if you've got real good friends, they'll loan you a rig for a while, and you can find out, gee, do you like the way the front panel operates, and the way the VFO knobs work, and the way all the push buttons work, and the memories work, and so on. And then, let's see what John's going to say. John, tell us what you suggest.
Dick, I was just wondering if Hal's around. He might have some information that would be good for Hank.
Good suggestion, because Hal collects all kinds of equipment, lots of it. K6 DPZ, I wonder if you're within earshot, Hal. K2LIW in the TechNet. You will hear Hal on at various times during the day, almost every single day, Hank. I recommend you latch on to him. If you go to his website, which I think if you QRZ.com, his call letters, you'll see a website you can go to. You go to that website and you look at the photographs of the stuff that he's got in his laboratory or in his warehouse, I'm going to call it. So when it comes to every piece of Hallicrafters, Collins, Drake, Cushcraft, ICOM, he has used almost every one of those pieces of equipment throughout his career. And a lot of that stuff has passed through. He's one of these guys who uses a rig for a while, trades it in, tries another one. He's tried lots and lots of rigs. When it comes to used equipment, and I strongly recommend used equipment for me. Let me drop a call. Like the thing you're listening to right now is a Kenwood TS-711A 2-meter all-mode base station rig. How probably 1985, 1990 vintage. That's what, 25 years old. But it's an oldie but a goodie from my point of view. It's got a built-in 110-volt power supply and a handle on the side. And not too bulky, easy to move. You plug it into 110 volts, you don't have to worry about a separate 12-volt power supply. I think it's only got 30 or 40 memories, but has the world's best frequency synthesizer I've ever seen. Very clean sideband. It's got a knob on the front panel where I can adjust the power output from 1 watt up to 30 watts inclusive. Slowly turn that knob on the front panel and adjust the power output. So when this becomes a tunable IF for a transverter for the higher microwave bands, to me it's an ideal base station rig for that characteristic. This 2-meter all mode, you can probably buy it on the used market for $300 to buy the exact same quality. And most of these things, except for a little bit of digital processing, the modern-day rig that does the same thing is closer to $2,000. And you can get this for $300. And so some of the older rigs, you get an awful lot for the money. When you buy an older used rig, let me drop it. You do enough checking around with your friends and or email, I mean the website, articles and so on, you'll find the ones that people have come to know and love, the ones that have a very good track record. And you buy one of those used pieces of equipment with a good track record, even if it's been thrown down a flight of stairs and the front panel has got a dent in it. And you get a guy, like some of the guys we got in this club, that are very good at repairing equipment. They own a service monitor and almost anything that can get it back on the air for you. As such, buying a so-called lemon with one exception doesn't exist. That one exception is there was a production run of ICOM 271s that were done 10, 15 years ago, where they forgot to use the acid, the washing bath to remove all the rosin from the PC boards. And this very active rosin that was used in the flow solder machine was so active that over the next few years it ate its way into the bearings of the variable capacitors, it ate its way into the integrated circuits, created all kinds of intermittent failures of the synthesizer, the receiver, the transmitter, the power output stage, everything became flaky in that rig. With that one exception, you can't go very wrong with used equipment if you've got friends that know how to repair things. Let me drop. So the bottom line is that if you buy a rig with a good track record, and for some reason you find a rig you fall in love with, that's even better later, and you want to resell that used piece of equipment, most of the time you can get 80% of your money back, and you didn't spend very much in the first place, and you got an awful lot for the money. So I'm a used equipment person. I'm also a used car driver. The fact that that brand new automobile loses a few thousand dollars the instant you drive it out of the showroom, that bothers me. And a used car doesn't do that. So this is my philosophy. It might not be yours, but I do recommend you do some checking and find out what are the rigs that people have come to know and love, their favorites. And as such, even if it's 15 or 25 years old, don't let that slow you down, because some of the older pieces of equipment are very well done. Drake, in particular, made some real good equipment. The Drake R4C receiver, which I think was made around 1985, has arguably the world's best noise blanker I have ever seen. The noise blanker that you can buy as an option for the Drake R4C is so good that when the Montauk Point radar in 432 megacycles was operational, there were times when it gave me a signal 120 decibels above my noise. I could find that out by putting step attenuators between the antenna. That's a potent signal. And I turned on that noise blanker. I could aim my antenna directly at Montauk Point with this 120 dB above the noise signal, and a weak signal on 432 off the back lobes of the antenna of a guy in New Jersey. I had no trouble hearing him when the noise blanker was on, and I would never hear any of that radar. My goodness, was that a noise blanker. And I studied that circuit to find out how in the world did Drake do that. So Mr. Drake in Miamisburg, Ohio is where I think he was located.
Repeater, time out.
That Drake company, they had the ability to build some extremely good equipment. V7, R7 series, I think was slightly different, but still There are some people out there who think it was the best thing ever done. So you're going to have to check with your friends on that one. There's no easy solution on this one. I don't know of anybody who has written articles listing all of the older used equipment, telling you which ones